Hello, hello, and welcome to another exciting episode of Skeptics and Seekers Sunday Sermon. This is David and Mac. How are you doing, Mac?
I'm pretty tired, but I'm all right.
No, I hear you. I think both of us probably have work schedules that are running us ragged. So,
pretty much.
But that's cool. You know, I really wish we had time to go over, you know, some of the last stuff that we were talking about on the board that you were wrong about. but neither one of us have that kind of time either. So I'm going to try to do an after show. I plan to talk for about 40 minutes on here. This might even be considered a supplemental. I'm not sure. But it's something that got left on the cutting room floor last week that was intended to be discussed in the after show, but was not, which is a thing you said and we discussed for like a couple of minutes. It needs more time, though, and that is the concept of the whole counsel of God. And I believe I said in the show, I don't even know what that is. I don't know, practically speaking, what that means or what that could even mean. And I wrote a little bit on the board. So anyone who wants to follow the discussions on the board, skepticsandseekers.squarespace.com, just log into your discuss account, discuss away. You can send an email at skepticsandseekers@gmail.com. Mac, since you use this expression a lot, I'm going to give you the first crack at explaining what it is you mean, because I've got a feeling that different Christians mean different things by this expression, the whole counsel of God.
Well, it pretty much means that when it comes to how you do theology, that you take care that you don't emphasize some texts over and against others. So, for instance, if you read a passage that says God is love, you're like, oh, okay. But then there's another part of the Bible where God is judging people. You don't say, well, I don't like the judging. I like the loving more. So let's find a way to make the judging look like maybe it's not on the same tier. So pretty much picking and choosing which texts you prefer. And so in that sense, you could say you're doing theology, sure, but you're not engaging with the full counsel of what's. It's like if the president gave out a law or something like that and says, okay, you have to do these things, and then you're like, oh well, I'll only do these things, but I won't do the other things, then you're not following the full counsel of the president. And so the same thing with theology, especially biblical theology.
Okay, let me poke at that a little bit. So when you say it, you are just trying to weed out the cafeteria Christian. That takes a little bit of this, but none of that, because I don't like mushrooms, but I'll take some of this. So is that correct?
Pretty much, yeah, buffet Christianity, where you know you're at a buffet, you're like, I'll take the stuff I like. And I know the person isn't ignorant about what's in the Bible. They know it's there. Mm-hmm. It's not like the person just doesn't know. They know about it, and they're like, I don't like that that's there. And they're like, okay, I'm not gonna go with that. I'm not gonna talk about it. I'm not even gonna think about it. I'm just gonna go with what I like.
Okay, so I just wanted to make sure that I understood where you're coming from. So someone like Jefferson in the Jefferson Bible.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, or Martian. Is it Martian or Marcion?
Marcion.
Marcion, okay.
Yeah.
So those would be people who don't follow the whole counsel, the full counsel of God, as you formulated.
Yes, they would be the best examples.
Yeah, okay.
And but then there's more nuanced like examples, but like those are the best. Like, you wouldn't find someone today very, I don't want to say rare, but it's becoming common where people do what Marcion did and still insist that they're doing accurate theology.
Right. So where does hermeneutics come into play here? Because I think that sometimes what you might say, someone is not following the full counsel of God in their picking and choosing, and what they would say in response is, no, I am following the full counsel of God. I'm using sound hermeneutical principles to determine what specifically applies to me as opposed to what doesn't. So, for instance, no one today, except maybe Orthodox Jews, would have a problem with wearing clothes with mixed fabrics. There may be some other people in that group, but in the mainstream, we wear clothes with mixed fabrics all the time. We eat shrimp. Shrimp is delicious. These are things that were forbidden by name, forbidden in God's system. And so you might accuse us of not following the full counsel of God. You know the Bible, you know what the Bible says about shrimp. And we would say, yeah, I know what the Bible says about shrimp, but that doesn't apply to us today because of this or that hermeneutical principle. Are you taking that into account?
So, like a conversation I would have with someone who's like Orthodox Jewish would be again, like I wish I had notes for this, but like if you study the Mosaic law closely, there are some laws that were meant to go away. So, for example, the tabernacle, right? You know that they had the tabernacle in the desert and stuff. So that eventually, like God told them, like when they get to the promised land, they were supposed to build a temple. But in the meantime, the tabernacle was supposed to work. So the Israelites, when they got to the promised land, they didn't even, like, not until Solomon was the temple built. So, like, for generations, they were just, they were just worshiping however they wanted. And God just kind of just let them keep doing their thing without, like, even to, like, even. The construction itself was like King David's idea,
Right.
but all that to say, like there's intricacies in the Mosaic law where like some laws are not binding. I would say lots of them are like for like situational, and they're just not binding on Gentiles. So the thing is, God's plan from the very beginning was to unite the nations to himself. And so like the laws that were given specifically to the Jews were meant for a time to show that they were set apart. Without going into too much detail, like that's just pretty much the basics of it. And so the wearing of the one fabric clothing and the hairstyles and everything supposed to like draw someone to be like, hey, what's up with these folks? Well, what's going on over there? And that's pretty much the gist of it.
Okay, so yeah, I think there are more threads, mixed fabrics to pull from this
Nice
particular
one.
shroud here. Just a little inside baseball. Both Mac and I just came are just coming off of work sessions, and we're tired. Brains are fried. We didn't even know. I had sent Mac an email last night saying, "Look, I can't do the show. Too much work. I'm not going to be able to do it." And then at the very last minute, I said, "No, I've made a little bit of progress. Let's go ahead and do it." We didn't even have a topic that we had discussed, and so I told him what I wanted to talk about. Then this was just a few minutes before the show started, folks. So have a little bit of charity for Mac and a lot of charity for me. Or however that works, but listen charitably. Look, Mac is certainly as good at this as I am. We can come on the show, we can make it look good, but we are not good this morning. I can tell you that right now. So,
I think the audience can tell from the voices and everything, but we're going to power through.
we are going to power through. So, okay. So you would acknowledge that there are some things in the Bible that aren't meant to continue, and we can use hermeneutical principles to determine what was intended for us and what wasn't intended for us, and what might have been a literal thing for some people, but might be figurative, when that, that may have been a shadow of something to come.
Yes,
All right.
the entire Bible, at least, if you want to say, okay, I want to understand what Christianity is, the whole Old Testament, from the temple to the figures themselves, Moses, Elijah, David, all these are just prefigurings of Christ. And that's pretty much that's a hermeneutical principle. Like, that's the principle that the early Christians used to understand where Christ fit into this story that's been told from Genesis all the way till their present day.
Right. And for the
Yeah.
record, I disagree with that as a hermeneutical principle. But I grant, I mean, even the denomination I grew up with talked about types and antitypes and that sort of thing. So I understand it. I just don't think it's a legitimate way to do literary criticism, because it makes an assumption that what they wrote 2,000 years before was in any way related to what was going on at that time, 2,000 years later. And so that's kind of a thing that you layer onto the text, and you'd say, well, Moses prefigured Christ. Well, no, he didn't. The people who wrote Moses had no concept of Jesus. The people who wrote about David had no concept of Jesus. And so you just have to kind of add a magical gloss onto it. Well, but the Holy Spirit is the one that is keeping the thread pure throughout the story. And so, great, that's a theological, faith-based idea, but it is not true as literary hermeneutics.
Well, you could again take a closer look at what these fellows themselves wrote. So, like with David himself, and there was a big discussion about this on the boards when I was talking to Brian B, and we were talking about Psalm 22 and saying David is talking about his suffering, and he's talking about his enemies are surrounding him and they pierce his hands and his feet. And so I asked Brian, pierce hands and feet, what does that sound like? And he was like, I don't know, maybe he's just emotional stuff. And I was like, wait, okay, no, wait, what does pierce hands and feet sound like to you? And he was like, he just couldn't answer, honestly. And the answer is like, okay, that sounds like crucifixion. So it's like, the thing is, like, people read these things like David wrote about like he prefigured crucifixion. Even if he was just writing about his misery and people are just being jerks to him, there's that thing going on there. And even we have Moses, like, talking about one day, I think it's the end of Deuteronomy, he says that God is going to, like, have to change your hearts, or like circumcise your hearts so that you may follow him. Now, that idea in and of itself finds its fulfillment in the teachings of Jesus, because for a while people thought that to be a good Jew, what you had to do was to just keep the law. But like Moses, in his final speech, and anyone can go read it, final chapter of Deuteronomy, he pretty much says that you people are not going to be able to keep these laws. Like, he says, after I die, I know you're not going to be able to follow these rules. God's going to have to come and do something for you in your hearts. And that specific teaching finds its fulfillment in what Christ teaches about being born again and all that.
Okay, I take your point, but it doesn't change my point. So I can say that I have no idea what David was on about with piercing of the hands and feet, but it's only a faith statement that you make that it's about crucifixion. Well, that sounds like crucifixion to me, you see? So I'm going to say it's about crucifixion. I can guarantee you that you're not going to find very many Jewish scholars who agree with you. Because they know the literary form way better than you or I, and they are not going to say this was David prophesying about Jesus being crucified. So, you know, I think that it requires a Christian perspective and a faith perspective to read these Old Testament passages and get there. By the way, I think that Paul did read the Bible like that. I think he was one of the first to read the Bible like that. So I'm not saying that no one read the Bible like that, but Paul was bringing in some new ideas about Judaism. I don't want to go down this road. Judaism was dying, and there were a lot of people, a lot of interpretation, who were trying to find ways to keep their religion and culture alive in the face of the fact that they had no promised land, no money, no power. So what does Judaism look like in that situation? So I think that Paul was one of the people who came up with, some different and interesting interpretations, of those passages. And he may not have even been the one. I don't think he was the only one who came up with interesting and bespoke interpretations of that stuff. But that said, just because Paul claimed that this was a prefiguring of, crucifixion and Jesus and, you know, what have you, that doesn't mean it is. That's just one guy using bad hermeneutics to lay a foundation to his new idea.
Well, again, like, that's an interesting theory. But again, like, the way the ancient Hebrews read their scriptures, they would see things like that and be like, this is just not a mere coincidence. So like, you're saying that they made it up, and I'm like, I don't think they could make it up, because so like you say, okay, you said Jewish scholars would be able, like, if they were to affirm that Psalm 22 is a prefiguring of Christ, then they would need to stop being Orthodox Jews, because again, the whole chapter itself is a big story about crucifixion and someone suffering and then God vindicating them through a resurrection in the end. So again, if you look at it in the original language, it's not what some people say. Especially that verse where it's people say, like a lion, my hands and my feet, that doesn't even make sense in the context. So again, it just comes out to, what are you choosing to believe to be true? Because if you're like, if you don't want it to be true, then it won't be true. But if you're like being a seeker, as Dale is fond of saying, and you see, wow, like this, who else could this be referring to? Like, I can see it refers, okay, David is going through it, but it also applies to Christ. And there's like so many other such portraits all over the Bible that point forward to Christ.
Okay, well, I mean, to make that case, you would just have to say that Jewish scholars don't understand their literature and Christians are better suited to understand Jewish literature than Jewish scholars. I don't buy it. And I will say that not even all Christians interpret those passages in Isaiah and Jeremiah and such places as being any kind of prophecy for Jesus. In fact, the first time I remember, the first time I came across this idea, it was from a couple of Christians who had co-authored a book that I can't think of the name of now. It's been a long time, but I used it actually in an adult Bible study, and we worked through that book. And so I don't even need to go to Jewish scholars to find even Christians who read that in other ways. So, you know, once again, it's a valid argument
you're making. It's valid, but like my point is this, like the first people who saw it were Jews themselves. Like the first Christians were Jewish people. So if they say it, like it's a question of which Jews do you favor more. Like I'm sticking with the original crew that saw the fulfillment of Christ in their own scriptures, and they were Jewish themselves. It wasn't like some random Romans or Greeks who saw him be like, "Oh, that's interesting. It was Jews.
Yeah,
They
but
were
I would
Jews
say
and they caught."
they were Jews on the edge of their culture. They were, and so I know that you would say, well, maybe Peter and the others were, far away from the actual Jewish culture. You might acknowledge that, but you might then come back and say, but Paul, he was a, right dead center of Orthodox Judaism, but we have his word on that. Paul changed his mind. Paul was rejected by the Jews, and for all we know, he was rejected before he turned to Christianity. Maybe that's why he turned to Christianity. I mean, historically, we have no insight into that. What we do know is that the actual Jewish leaders of that time, who also knew their Bible, did not read the texts that way. And so you can say, well, I will accept the interpretation of the rebels, and I can say I will accept the interpretation of the Orthodox.
Well, actually, when you look, like if you read Josephus's I'm blanking out, but he kind of like recounts the history of the Jewish people, and he's pretty much doing the same thing that Matthew does, where he's like doing like typology and stuff and saying, "Oh, look, this is a type of this." Same with that guy Philo. I don't know if you've heard of him, Philo of
Yeah, I have.
Alexandria. Yeah, he loves Moses, so he mostly like wrote commentaries on the first five books, and he pretty much does the same thing. He's looking at the scriptures and he's making typologies and doing the same thing. And he's the guy actually who first uses the word logos in referring to God.
I did not
And
know that.
then John, when John 1, and it says in the beginning was the word and everything. So he pretty much just like the thing that they were doing, what the Christians were doing, the Jewish Christians, it like just pretty much to counter what you said, they were not doing anything that other Jewish folks weren't already doing. So if
I agree with that.
another, yeah, you agree with
I
that.
wasn't
Okay.
yeah, I wasn't suggesting that at least I wasn't trying to suggest that this was a new thing they were doing, but it was
Okay.
a new interpretation of a thing that they did, which is one of the reasons why I don't think it's a valid hermeneutical principle. Jews debated their religion fervently, a lot. And so you can, I mean, there was a lot of argument over what this means or what that is. And, people with an interpretive method as open as theirs was, you could come up with all kinds of things, and they did. So, I don't think the whole typology as a hermeneutic is a valid hermeneutic for literature. And, one way we know that is because we don't use it in literature today.
Again, that's like in a way you're like taking English literature and the rules that we have in English literature and taking
Right,
it and saying,
but
okay, well.
if it was valid though, we'd be able to do it. We'd be able to look at Shakespeare and say, okay, there, King Lear is a type for Obama, who is the anti-type, and we would say that you see Shakespeare prefigured King Lear
Well,
prefigured we could do all kinds of things like that if that was a legitimate way of actually going about textual criticism. It's not, which is why we don't.
right, but you realize that in the Bible, like there's all kinds of covenants and promises that God says, I'm gonna do this, I'm gonna bring a leader, I'm gonna do this. Like even I think Malachi ends with like a promise of Elijah showing up or something through the last chapter. And then there's a place in Ezekiel where God promises he's gonna send David. Now, at this point in history, David has been long dead in the in and his corpse is rotting in the ground. So what the Jewish folks are doing is that they're looking at these passages and they're saying, what does that mean? Because it can't be the literal David and can't be the literal Elijah. So these are promises that are being made, and so they're going to have to find their fulfillment. Now, I know you don't believe in prophecy or fulfillment or anything like that, but they did, and they thought about these things. And for the Christians, in light of what Christ did, like he came and he did his thing, lived, died, rose again, ascended into heaven. And they are like, oh, wow, now it makes all of it make sense all the way from the beginning all the way to Malachi. It all clicks together. Everyone else has their interpretation, but it all makes sense if you see Christ as a fulfillment of what came before.
Sure.
And that's
And
what full counsel means, pretty much.
okay, so I do good. Because I wanted to get back to full counsel because I'm looking at the clock and we got about 10 more minutes if we're going to hit that 40-minute thing. And so I wanted to go back to the New Testament. So some of the things that Paul had to say to women, I think that some of this discussion might fit in the whole counsel idea. So you might say, well, you can't just pick and choose. Paul said that women should not usurp or even have authority over men, and so women pastors are a sinful thing. But Paul also said that women shouldn't go to worship with their head uncovered. And speaking specifically about hats and veils and such. We don't wear veils today. And so, what the Christian who happens to believe that women should remain silent in the church and not have authority over men, they would say, well, that's literal and applies to us today. But as far as women wearing hats and veils, not so much. Understand, I grew up in a church culture where women did wear hats and veils, and a lot of them didn't. And they were frowned upon. And so I was kind of in that transitionary period for my particular denomination. But that would be a thing where someone could easily say, well, you're not following the whole counsel of God because Paul clearly said that you got to wear a veil. And we would say, yeah, no, we don't. So how do you see that sort of thing working with the whole counsel of God idea that you have?
Yeah, some churches have compromised on that, and yeah, they have. I mean, it's not a question of like, yeah, we don't. And I also, when I was a little kiddo, I remember, like, this is such a distinct memory in my head. I knew instinctively if I saw a woman with a hat on that she was going to church. I don't know why that, like, it was such a tradition. Like, okay, she's got her head covered, she must be going to church. And I was like, okay, that makes sense. But these days, it's not a thing. And so it's like, is it that the church forgot about it? But I'll say this, like, if you go to places
We could throw long hair in there too, women with long hair versus short
long
hair,
hair.
because
Oh, I don't
we had
know.
whole
I don't know
sermons
about
about
that
that.
one. I don't know about that one.
Yeah, well, Paul said it. He was very specific
About
about
men
it.
having long hair. And
Yeah, and about yeah, because
I know.
women often these days get buzz cuts.
But like again, with such a command, again, you kind of have to also like I'm sorry, I'm not even I'm kind of, my brain kind of froze there.
Well, no, it's okay. So would it so a woman with a buzz cut and no hat at church, would you say that she's not following the whole counsel of God?
Not in the same sense as someone who perhaps like is like, well, universalism is true and hell doesn't exist. It's different tiers.
Okay,
With
so you're saying it's a matter of degree, but let's set the degrees aside. Is that person not following the whole counsel of God, because that person is using a hermeneutical principle that says this is a clearly cultural thing meant for specific people at a diff specific time and place,
Yeah,
right?
like
That's valid. That's
that's an idea. Yes, that's, I mean, if that's how they see it, then I believe like when it comes to stuff like Again, you don't like this. I know you don't, but I'm gonna say it anyway. When it comes to like theological triage, where you sort out the important doctrines from the non-important, like the top tier, first order stuff that you have to affirm in order to be a Christian. So, nature of God, nature of Christ, nature of salvation. And then there's a second tier, and then there's a third tier, and then there's maybe a fourth tier or something where people are like, we don't use instruments at our church because we don't like that. So let's say someone is under deep conviction that because people in the early church didn't use guitars and electric drums, those shouldn't be seen in church. And a whole debate arises. But like with the hairstyle thing, again, it's a question of culture. Like, what did Paul's culture look like when he was writing that? Was there something related to women's hairstyles and how people perceived women who had elaborate hairstyles? Because I know, in that culture, if you were walking around with your head uncovered, then that kind of meant that you were a kind of prostitute. Well, obviously that's not true today, but that's what it was like for his day. So we have to be able to sift through things like that and be able to sort out what applies to us and what does not apply to us today.
Right. So what that would lead me to suggest is you should be more charitable when someone disagrees with you about something theologically and saying that they're not following the whole counsel of God, because they might well be following the whole counsel of God from their perspective, because they're using a hermeneutical principle that you're not. And even if they're using it incorrectly, that's not an example of not following the whole counsel of God, in my opinion. That
Well,
is just using it, a bit of textual criticism incorrectly.
yeah, I would be interested in knowing why someone believes the things they do. Again, even with something like Calvinism, which is a hot button topic, and people just get so bent out of shape about it. Like with that, it's okay. What hermeneutical principles are you using? Like, we could start by like saying, okay, what are the things that we both have in common? What are the things that we believe in common? And then from there, we work towards, like finding a way in which we can understand other doctrines in the same way that we understand the things that we agree upon. And usually, like, again, this. I'm not excluding myself from this because I know for sure there are things that I may believe that are just totally wrong about, things like what do people get? All right, like baptism or the Lord's Supper, things like that, right? Because there's a whole bunch of views. But the thing is, if I'm talking to someone who has a different view, I would want them to be able to like just put their hermeneutical principles on the table, and then I'll put mine on the table, and we can be like, oh, okay, let's try and sort it out, as opposed to just saying, well, you're stupid, you don't know what you're talking about, and the person says the same thing to me, then no one gets helped in that situation.
All right. So I'm looking at the clock, and I think that's good. I think that's a good conversation. I do have a thought that I want to do for an after show that might be 15 minutes. So even though we have not yet implemented our thing, we need to get into the practice of doing it. And so you know how to reach us, skeptics and seekers at squarespace.com. Log your discuss account, discuss away, send us an email, skeptics and seekers at gmail.com, which is an email that Mac does not yet have access to because I just haven't given it to him yet. But I will continue to say send us, because I will at some point. All right. I promise. So with that, we will see you in the comments after show. Okay.
Yeah, well, I just know people are just gonna post off-topic stuff. So, to the two people who listen to the show, looking forward to any ideas that you have, constructive criticism, or just say, well, I didn't understand this part. Like, honestly, the best thing is for all of us to come out of this learning something new, as opposed to being like, well, what you said was so dumb, or
Yeah, and I
yeah.
think one of the if nothing else, you can learn, understand, and empathize what the other person is thinking and going through, and humanize people that you strongly disagree with, right? So, and I think the world becomes a better place if we can just do that. But I think that we have more opportunities than just that. But I mean, I think that's important if we can, if that's all we can manage. So that said, all right, Mac, I want to rewind, go back to my comment on the board about this topic and relitigate what it means to know the Bible. Because I can't let this go, and I feel like it there's more meat on this bone. So know the Bible. I said something to the effect that we can't, there's no way to determine what the what were we talking about on the board? But I was at any rate questioning what it even means to know the Bible, and to fully understand the whole counsel of God. Because what that sounds like to me is you can't know anything unless you know everything. And I don't believe that for a moment. I don't think that you have to know everything to know anything, even about religion, theology.
Right.
I think that there are some, partial knowledge is fine. It because that may be all some people can muster. But it's a matter of knowing the right bits and pieces rather than knowing the whole counsel. And so I just want to I want to ask some very specific questions, like how much really does a person have to know? Do you have to know, with some intimate familiarity, every verse in the Bible, every Bible story, the thrust of every book of the Bible? Do you have to know the Bible's history? Do you have to know cultural norms at the time, things like that? So what does it mean to know the Bible?
Well, I believe I said this, if not to you, to someone else. I used this sentence. I said, the main things are the plain things, and the plain things are the main things. So when it comes to the Bible has a very simple message. One is that humans are sinners, and two, that God saves sinners. So if I were to summarize, like, let's say I was going to visit someone who's like on their deathbed, and they're like, tell me about Christianity. Do I give them a whole lecture on from Genesis to Revelation, or do I just tell them, can I summarize it in like 10 minutes?
Yeah, because
And
otherwise the
out,
guy's gonna die in the middle of
yeah,
the
he's gonna
begats.
die in the genealogies.
Which is a bad way to die, let me just say.
It's like the, yeah, but the I don't know why you're laughing. This is it's fatigue. It's not because I'm laughing that someone is dying.
No. I'm laughing at someone who's dying, who's got a priest who's going through the begats. So
Yeah,
that's a
I've never understood what the priest does.
I don't either.
But like the point is, okay, you 10 minutes. I'm about to tell me what the important thing is, and like. Again, the story of the thief on the cross, the way that guy goes to heaven or paradise is the same way that every single person gets into heaven, not by their own efforts, but by Christ's intercession for them, Christ interceding for a person. So that guy was nearly dying, and he asks for forgiveness. He says, I'm guilty, you're not guilty. Remember me when you come into your kingdom. And so you have the guy acknowledging his own sin and seeing Jesus and seeing that even though from his vantage point it didn't look like it, saying that Jesus could save him and saying, "Remember me." So we are sinners. We all know this. Like, even if we wouldn't admit it, like, we all mess up. We all make bad choices. And the only hope we have is for someone to be our substitute and do stuff so that our sin, in a sense, is atoned for. And that's what Christ did. He atoned for our sins. But also, not just that, he lived the life we never could live on our own. And so what happens is, because he is divine, and the sins that we commit are like in a divine kind of bank account, he's the one who's able to pay off that sin debt and give us his perfect righteousness. So pretty much, being a Christian is about transformation and about new life, and not staying in the same place you're staying. So to summarize it, I would tell the person, the most important thing to know is about yourself, and also to know who God is. God is a savior. You're a sinner, and if you'd go to God, he will not turn you away. That's pretty much the gist of the entire Bible,
Okay,
from
and it would be
Genesis to
it would be
Revelation.
a better Bible if that's all it said, as far as I'm
Well,
concerned.
that's again, if again, so that's for the person who's like 10 minutes away from dying. For the person who has like 50 years to go, right? Obviously, that's not going to be enough for them.
Why?
It's enough, but it's not going to be enough. Why? Well, because if you stick with that for 50 years, then you're going to get tripped up by all sorts of things that say, well, you're not living your life like Christ wants you to live life, so you're not trying hard enough, so it's possible that you're not really saved. And it's like, wait, like, and some people believe that. They believe that it's up to their performance to earn them eternal life.
Right, but if they were having a divine presence within them via sensus divinitatis or whatever, they would know that they were saved all the time. So that I disagree with the premise that they would start thinking that they weren't
Well,
saved. I don't think you
some
could
people who
think
are
it.
saved for real still doubt that they are saved, and
Then
that doubting,
they have no sensus divinitatis, and that's a bunch of
well,
BS.
that's, wait, how does that work? How do they? Because doubts can be a means of like, let's say you don't like math analogies, but you're doing a math problem, and you're like, okay, you do it, and then you're like, wait, let me check the proof. Let me do a proof to see if the answer I got is right. That doesn't mean that the answer you put in is wrong. It just means you're like, okay, let me make sure that I didn't
Okay,
mess
but we
up.
don't have a sensus divinitatis telling us that our math answer is right. So
Chris,
that's why it's
well,
disanalogous.
you have an instinct. Like, you
Okay,
wait,
but
when you take
we don't
text.
have the God of math living inside of us telling us when
Well,
our answers are right
Christians
or
do.
wrong.
That's the
Right.
thing.
So
Christians do.
that's what I mean though. If they did, they would never doubt. It would
No,
be impossible to doubt. God's li he's right here, man.
I don't see, because the doubt itself is a means of God showing you that, okay, so let me, okay, so someone who is not saved, right, and is just living their life however they want to live, they don't have that sense of what's it like, okay, I need to repent, I did something wrong, I need to ask God for forgiveness. Doesn't have that at all. The Christian has that. When they mess up, they're like, oh, I'm sorry, I offended you, Lord. And they ask God for forgiveness, and they repent, and they turn away from their sin. So that turning away, that doubting, that turning back, that whole process in and of itself is the proof. But like, Paul again talks about this in Romans. He's like, don't sin so that you can, like, tell yourself, like, okay, this is proof that I'm a Christian, because there's a temptation again to be like, okay, I'm just going to keep living my life however I want to live. It's like, no, don't do that, because that also, in a paradoxical way, shows that you're not serious, or you're not actually saved if
Right,
you're
but if they,
still.
once again, if they've got God living in them in some tangible way, they wouldn't want to sin anyway. So that
Right.
I
They would
just
want to sin less.
right.
They're not sinless, but they want to sin less.
They wouldn't even ask the question, shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? That wouldn't make sense to even wonder about.
You see, like logically, that's what people, well, by human logic, that's what people say, right? If it's
Right,
all
but the
grace, then why
unsaved,
can't I just.
the unsaved would say that. The saved would never say it.
No, but the unsaved say that to the saved people. They say, hey,
And the saved
if
people would
it's all
say,
grace. No, someone told me, actually gave me this comment this week on the board. They're like, okay, I'm just going to wait for God's grace to come upon me. And I'm just going to fold my arms. I'm going to sit here. I'm going to wait for the grace to show up. And it's like, that's not how grace works. It's not like, okay, if I'm saved, then I don't have to do anything. Like I don't have to exert my will in a certain way. Like my exertion of my will proves that I have actually been saved. If I actually don't care, then that's proof that I don't actually have God living in
Okay.
me. Yeah.
So 10 minutes, and I don't even want to use all of those. I want to say something controversial. I haven't thought it through. So this might be fun. No one who was saved in the Bible knew the Bible.
Okay.
So this emphasis on knowing the Bible seems to be a very strange emphasis, since no one in the Bible knew the Bible. So
Yeah.
they
Yeah, people on the cross never read Galatians, never read Ephesians, never knew anything about Revelation or eschatology or any of that stuff. That's why the emphasis is that Christ is the one who saves you, not how much theology you've got in your head or how much Bible you read. The Bible is a means that God uses for Christians who are not going to be dying anytime soon as a way to keep you from, I guess, being sucked into the vortex of worldliness. Does that answer your question?
No. I mean, it's words that make good sounds, though.
Well, I want to answer the question so that it doesn't
Well, I
sound
mean,
like just words.
someone listening may think you answered the question, and I just don't see it. To me, when I look at Jesus wandering around the countryside, he never asked anyone, so how much of Isaiah do you know? He never did that. He talked about the kingdom of heaven, and it's soon coming and now is, and it's in your heart. And there was no first study Jeremiah, that simply didn't exist.
Well, I disagree because he went around actually telling people, have you not read what Moses told you, or did you not remember the prophets? Like, that's
When he was
all over the
talking to
gospel.
Jewish, hang on, when he was talking to Jewish leaders who he
Right, because
didn't
they were
consider
like,
saved and who he was perfectly
well, you
free to
said
be
he never
rude
went
to,
around telling people that, but he talked
but
from the
those
Old
they weren't
Testament.
saved. And my specific formulation was no one who was saved in the Bible knew the Bible.
So, like an example would be like Paul or Peter.
Right. Well, Paul wasn't saved because he knew the Bible. So it's true
Right.
that he knew the Old Testament, but his knowledge of the Old Testament did not lead him to Jesus. His
Right. I'm
knowledge of the
agreeing
Old
with you.
Testament led him to persecute. And so
Yeah.
this is what I'm talking about. It wasn't Bible knowledge that people needed to have. And there, I can't think off the top of my head anyway, of a single person who I would say knew the Bible when they were saved. Or at least who knew it accurately.
Well, no one actually knows it accurately. Like, that's why you have to learn. If you have to learn
Okay,
something,
but they
there's a
who okay,
censor if
who
you
didn't
don't
know
know
it,
it.
who didn't know it heretically almost. Paul's knowledge of, I'm sorry.
I'm
Go ahead.
sorry, Apollos, right? Like
Right.
he was very he and then the two the couple, Priscilla
And
and Aquila,
Aquila.
and they take him aside and they're like they instruct him properly how to, preach or evangelize, and he's like, okay, cool, got it. And so like you have folks all over the like even in Acts 15 when they're deciding on whether the Gentiles should be whether they should eat food sacrificed to idols, and they go and they find a verse in Amos something and they say, well, actually the word of God says this about how God is gonna join the Gentiles to himself through
Those
the
are people who are
gospel.
already saved, so don't really count in
So
my
you're talking
formulation.
the Bereans,
They were already saved.
they weren't. It actually says that they were more. So Paul rolls into town and he preaches the gospel, and then they're like, oh, nice, cool. We'll get back to you after we confirm what you said lines up with what is in the scriptures. And then Luke says they were more noble-minded than the believers in Thessalonica because they went and searched out the scriptures to see whether what Paul was saying was the truth. So again, there you have people who were studying the Bible to see if what the apostles were teaching was consistent.
I will conditionally grant the Berean example. I would have to go back and look at that carefully because I don't know that the Bereans were exactly unsaved at that point in time. But Paul did say that they searched the scriptures to see what he said was true. But once again, they're just Paul is giving an interpretation and they're looking at it to see if they can accept or not accept that interpretation. But at any rate, whether the Bereans are an exception or not, I think the rule stands pretty generally still that in the Bible, when people are saved, it wasn't because they knew the Bible.
Maybe I'm not understanding the questions. Like, they didn't know the Bible. Like, at some point they would have known the Bible. Like, if they know
Well,
God in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Like, they would have known something like that, right?
which
Genesis
okay, well,
1:1.
that wouldn't have contributed to their salvation, because at the time, for instance, when Peter preached to the crowd on Pentecost, well, many of the people that were there would have had some familiarity with some parts of the Bible. And you have to also remember that there were Jews who only believed that the Bible consisted of the books of Moses. So even among Jews, there wasn't even an agreement on what the Bible was exactly. So when Peter preaches, yeah, he gives a biblical reference or two, but mostly he's talking about Jesus, which was not in a Bible at that time. So even that sermon is not an example of people being saved because of Bible study. So I'm making this point to say the idea of you have to know the whole counsel of God doesn't make a lot of sense of almost any of the conversions that we read about in the New Testament.
Well, it does because, again, like a good example would be the Bereans, and then Jesus himself telling his disciples to like when he's talking to the two guys on the road to Emmaus, and he begins with Moses and he goes through all the prophets, beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained all the scriptures to
Right.
them.
And that's a good example, and I will grant that except to say those people were already Jesus followers. So it's not like
They
Jesus
weren't
was
active. They were.
it's
They
not
were.
like
They didn't believe he was alive. They were leaving Jerusalem. They were like, "We're out of
right. No,
here. He's
they
dead."
didn't believe he was alive, but nobody believed he was alive. So
Right.
even his own 12 or 11 at that time didn't believe he was alive. So let's
Right.
be
And Jesus gives them a Bible study. Like,
right,
he
but they
shows up
don't
and he's like, "Okay, Bible study
But
time,"
that's
while they're
not what
walking.
saved them. They were saved anyway. They were saved
Right.
at that time. The people on the road to Emmaus were saved before Jesus gave them a Bible study. His
Well, how
disciples
do
were
you
saved.
know that they were saved before Jesus gave the Bible study? It doesn't say that.
Okay, well, they were his disciples. It does say that.
They were his disciples, but they didn't believe that Jesus would. So, okay, so
Like I
Jesus said,
said,
"Go have a
nobody
wood and
believed
rise."
Jesus rose.
No one, right. No one believed. And so
So they
Jesus
didn't learn
shows
it from
up,
the
right?
Bible.
No, yeah, exactly. But like, no, wait. So Jesus shows up, and instead of saying, "Here I am," he starts with the Bible study from Genesis all the way to Malachi, whatever, or Second Chronicles. And once he's done, and they're like, no way, we want more Bible study. And then Jesus says, okay, I'll stay with you guys. And then they recognize him afterwards. So the Bible study comes first. And then Peter's sermon, he talks about David's Psalm. I think it's Psalm 16. He says, oh, Psalm, David wrote this in his Psalms about
Right.
how you'll not allow your Holy One to see decay. But David
Right.
is dead, so that has to be referring to the Messiah and something like that. So,
Right.
like every time the apostles are preaching, except I'll throw this one in for you so that if you want to use this in the future, you can, except when Paul is in Athens and he's talking to the people there who have no idea what who Jesus is or what the Hebrew scriptures are.
Right, but I would
And he
say
has
that
to
those people
go
were
and
never saved.
no,
So,
some people actually get saved from that sermon.
okay.
So if you want to use an example, use that example, because he starts with, okay, he quotes from their poets and he says, some of your poets have said this, we're all God's offspring.
Yeah,
Again,
yeah.
I'm butchering it, but
No,
you know what I'm
no.
saying,
Look,
right?
we're both going off the cuff here, and so I, like I said, I haven't thought this through completely, but I'll come back on the board if I have time to revisit this
Yeah,
to
I'm
pick it
trying to
up.
help you out.
No, I understand. I appreciate the steel man effort. I will consider it more. I think the general rule still favors me, but probably I would grant that it's not every situation. So I'll certainly look at that. Look, thanks for the discussion. The fact that neither one of us had any time or preparation or even knew that this was going to happen, I think we did pretty good. So with that said though, I think I'm going to get out of here and get back to this project, and we will see you next time.